record, make sure you're getting up into the microphone. Yeah. That's your
I realized that with Rob
kryptonite.
And I.
Yeah.
I was moving back. He was moving forward.
Yeah, I kept having to do this to Lindsay, like, come on, come closer. Welcome to Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rothis.
And we are in the studio together for the first time in like a month, because we recorded two episodes back to back and then released an oldie. Mm-hmm. And then we connected with our spouses and we've got some at least one special episode that's in the idea phase may involve Ginger and my wife Lindsay. Mm-hmm. So look forward to that. But we're back, and I said, well, actually, I think the way it went was Ginger said, "What do you want to talk about?" And I said, "I don't know. What do you want to talk about?" And then you said Parks and Recreation, because that is your life right now.
That's what we're watching right now.
Is Parks and Recreation. So let me ask, have you watched Parks and Recreation before?
No.
This is the first time.
I kept hearing how much everybody loved it. And so my family and I have gone through The Office, Schitt's Creek, and then we were like, oh, how about Parks and Rec? And so we're in the fourth season, and this is like a couple episodes every evening we do together.
Sure.
It's been a really fun, yeah. So probably Schitt's Creek probably wasn't the best mom move.
Oh, no, Schitt's Creek's great.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. They learned some new things. But so we're in the fourth season of Parks and Rec, and it took me a while to love everybody. Like, mm-hmm. It was slow the first season, I thought.
Oh, yeah. So my theory is it was first articulated, though I don't know if the creators really intended this. So Michael Schur is sort of the primary mm-hmm. creator of the show, who is also one of the creators of The Office. Mm-hmm. And so it had the same kind of mockumentary style. And it was sort of articulated as like, oh, it's an Office spinoff, mm-hmm. you know, like everybody thought like it was going to. And so I think that the first season really leaned into that.
Oh, interesting.
Which The Office is much more awkward humor.
Yes.
And not like haha, silly,
right.
absurd kind of humor. And so so the characters were not very likable.
Mm-hmm.
And like to a person, I think Anne mm-hmm. was the only kind of likable, same
yes.
kind of character. Everybody else was their own kind of like wacky, out of touch
yes.
kind of person. Luckily, the first season was a short season. It was not very many. It was only like maybe 12 episodes or something like that. And then the second season, really partway through, they started to lean into Leslie Knope went from like incompetent to hyper competent,
right?
And then in that sort of hyper competence was its sort of own silliness,
mm-hmm.
you know, its own, and that it made the show much more positive and much more fun to watch. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's I remember growing up watching cartoons. I watched a lot of cartoons, and they were always, I always put them into two categories. There were the cartoons where like things never work out for the main character, and the cartoons where things generally worked out for the main character.
Yes.
And I felt different ways watching each
right.
of those kinds of things, and Parks and Rec in its subsequent seasons really turned into a show where, you know, regardless of, you know, the sort of normal trappings of societal success and victory or whatever, like you're rooting for the characters.
Yeah.
Things generally tend to work out for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Not just, you know, a parade of misery.
Really great to watch it as a family too, because it really does teach a lot of relationship wisdom,
mm-hmm.
Of what matters, how to be kind to people, how to accept quirkiness,
mm-hmm.
you know, seeing somebody deeper than their behaviors in the office.
Sure.
And in the Parks and Rec office. It's been fun to, and my kids love it, and they get the quirky sense of humor
mm-hmm.
of the writing too.
Yeah.
But yeah, every season gets better, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, how many are there total?
There are seven.
Okay.
And so
we're about halfway.
Yeah. And well, the final season is not all that long. I think it was truncated. It was a kind of mid season, like they came back at a mid season point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it is a, for me, one of the more consistently entertaining shows, where I pretty much know, like, I can I can pick any episode mm-hmm. and watch it. And for a long time, like I would, like, I think I texted you, like, I probably watched the whole thing through maybe like six times. Just because I think that there are very few duds. There are very few episodes that I come away from thinking like, oh, you know, this isn't a good one. You know, in season four, which is the primary focus is on the Leslie Knope's run for city council,
exactly.
I think has a lot of really interesting commentary on the political process. Mm-hmm. The next season, which I won't tell you how it turns out, but has a different take on, you know, how the political process works. But as you look at Parks and Rec watching it with fresh eyes, mm-hmm. what are some of the relational lessons you find yourself becoming aware of that are sort of shining through as you watch
it? Yeah, probably a couple of them that I'm intrigued with is the mentoring relationship between Ron and Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's developed through the episodes. But I love they're such different people, right? They're wired very differently. Ron could care less, and Leslie's mm-hmm. hypervigilant about her job. And yet Ron is who she goes to when she needs advice or, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a rock solid presence
right.
in her life. So watching the mentoring relationship has been one thing I've enjoyed there. And then the other one that came to mind when we were brainstorming what to talk about was how in season four, Tom is launching his media
mm-hmm.
company
yeah.
and he's so self-absorbed. And then he agrees to do a campaign party for Leslie and makes it all about him
mm-hmm.
when she's running for office. And so she's furious. But then in the end, she has compassion for him because she understands his hurt is that he's about to go bankrupt and he's a failure. And so, you know, to me, watching that was kind of a lesson in grace and mercy. And also, it's okay to be angry, but it's also she put herself in his shoes,
right,
which
right.
you and I have talked about a lot of what's it feel to be like that person.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like my kids are watching some really great relationship lessons as they laugh through that show. You know, I remember growing up with the Waltons, which was a long, long time ago in the 70s, I guess. Yeah. Late 70s, early 80s, probably the Waltons. And there was always this beautiful moral message. Little House on the Prairie was like that mm-hmm. for me, too. And so I've thought about what are my kids getting like that? And they really, I don't know that they have that show that they're anchored in that's teaching kind of values without, you know, blatantly teaching values.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I'm noticing in Parks and Rec is it does it through humor, which is mm-hmm. really a great way to teach.
Yeah. And I think the one of the things that I appreciate most is that whatever discord exists, it is usually there's reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is some space of you know, opportunity for mm-hmm. for re-engagement. To me, one of the episodes, probably the one that I've watched more than anyone, is the Snake Juice episode.
Yes.
I think the title of the episode is The Fight, where Leslie really wants Anne to apply for this part-time
That's
city
right.
hall position as like a public health mm-hmm. director or something like that. And Anne is like not super into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sort of discord of, and you know, some other things start to come out of like the way that Anne has been, you know, approaching her dating life and then, mm-hmm. Leslie's sort of overbearing, you know, nature and some of those types of things. Just watching kind of that unfold. And there's one of my favorite scenes is, so the next day everybody is just horribly hungover from this snake juice, which is just the like this worst drink imaginable. And Ben asks Leslie, says, "Are you okay?" And she says no.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so it's such an endearing moment
yeah.
of like acknowledging that you're not okay and that you're and then, you know, there's this move toward reconciliation. And that happens pretty consistently throughout the show, which is, I think, the energy that allows the those lessons to land, you know,
mm-hmm.
because it's not just a matter of, you know, so-and-so gets in trouble, so-and-so learns a lesson, and that's it. It's like, no, there's it's always a lesson that is born kind of in the fires of this kind of relational, this relational space. Let's dive into that, the mentoring relationship, yeah. and maybe why, Ron and Leslie are drawn to each other. Do you feel like you've had a similar mentor in your life or someone that has, you know, mirrored some of that dynamic? I'm curious.
I don't know. I'm thinking about my mentor relationships. I'm not sure I've landed on the one yet, mm-hmm. like Leslie has Ron. I think one of the things I see is Leslie's vulnerability in, and she gets mm-hmm. more comfortable telling Ron, you know, her truth and her struggles. And there's something I think that makes it safe to tell Ron her struggles because Ron could care less about the job. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the nuances of a mentoring relationship, I think, are I see your potential, I want the best for you, and I want to help you live into your potential. And so mm-hmm. I think that Ron kind of sees that in Leslie. And it's not who he is, but he admires that she has all this drive and wants to, you know, wants to rise in her political career. As ridiculous as he thinks it is, he supports her. And then what I see in Leslie is her vulnerability to say, I'm lost. I need help. And so, you know, when I think about have I had a mentor like that, I'm not sure I've had somebody that I felt that safe with to say, help me through this. Mm-hmm. I did have a seminary professor, Israel Kamazandu, who was probably that for me. I could sit with him and say, okay, I'm in a mess. What should I do? And his advice was always clean it up first and then move on. Yeah. And it was always, you know, not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear like, well, you're right and they're wrong. But he always gave me the tough advice. And that's what I see Ron doing with Leslie too, is yeah. like, I want the best for you, but sometimes that means you've got to do a hard thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that theme of reconciliation. Ron's always kind of bringing her back to, you know, a path of peace.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that if I look at kind of my mentor relationships, and I've had a handful, but what I see Ron and Leslie embodying is Ron is very consistent. Mm-hmm. He's not, and I think in a lot of ways when Leslie comes to Ron, she almost knows what he's going to say. Mm-hmm. And it is more about, so there's an accountability there. Mm-hmm. There's somebody that says like rarely do you see Ron saying, okay, Leslie, here's what I want you to do. You know, mm-hmm. do this thing, do that thing, do this thing. But it's really like reminding Leslie of what her values are and what's mm-hmm. important to her, which is, I think when we are caught up in, you know, the things that we're passionate about or the things of life, we can sometimes lose sight of our own values, you know, kind of, you know, lose the forest for the trees right. kind of thing. And Ron, because he is, you know, you could say that Ron is principled to a fault, yes. In some ways. He sort of remains reliable in the way that he approaches those things. My clinical supervisor, after I graduated, was a guy named Jason Kerrigan. Still somebody that I love dearly. I was just telling my wife the other day because I gave him a call, and he hasn't been supervising me for about 3 years, but I was going on vacation and I wanted somebody to be a backup in case my clients had any needs. And you know, he's kind of going through his own stuff, but he was like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do it. And I told my wife, I was like, I don't deserve Jason Kerrigan. Oh, because yeah. it's, he is somebody that is sort of always dependable. And toward the end of our supervisory relationship, one of the things that I noticed is he very rarely, redirected me. He very mm-hmm. rarely like said, oh, you know, you should have done it this way or yeah. you should have done it that way. It was really more of just like, he's like, yeah, that mm-hmm. sounds great. Like he was somebody that I could say, here's what I'm thinking. Am I way off base? Mm-hmm. And most of the time what he did was he would affirm my clinical instincts. He would say like, yeah, that the direction that you're going sounds, mm-hmm. you know, like the right direction, even though like that might not have been the way that he would approached it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think that there are some leaders who wants you to do it their way, who say like, you know, it's right. like, it's like, well, you did it this way, but here's the way that I would have done it. And instead he was somebody that would always say like, you know, the way that you're approaching it, I'm not seeing anything that's way out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, continue to pursue that path. So that steadiness and dependability, I think, is an important part of what makes that a successful relationship.
That's interesting. When I think about my mentor, Israel, he was from Zimbabwe originally and had, you know, a horrific story of watching the government kill his family because his dad was in politics in Zimbabwe. And so he came to the United States to be educated. And he does have that sage wisdom kind of peacefulness approach to things. And when I would ask his advice, it was exactly what you're saying. It was more of affirming, helping me trust my instincts, helping me, you know, and often it was, you know, the right answer, you know, which is what a great mentor does, I think, is you already know it. And I think you and I do that in our practices too, of, you know, I'll find myself saying, I think you have the answer already. Yeah. But let's talk through it so you can hear yourself say it.
Yeah.
But I think those are great mentoring relationships. And there is something in watching Leslie as she grows in her political career. I see her also getting more vulnerable with people at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so the arc of her character is really interesting to me, too. And part of a mentoring relationship is that vulnerability, being willing to ask for advice and ask for help and not go it alone.
Right.
And
right.
She does model that in the show in her relationship with Ron.
Yeah. I do think that there is a, you know, I'm not sure how far you are into season four. How far are you into season four?
I don't know.
What was the last thing you saw?
I can't remember. So Tom lost his business. He's coming back, though. I don't know.
Okay.
What are you thinking about?
Well, so I don't know if her and Ben, where
yes.
Her and Ben.
Okay, so they ended their romantic relationship so that she could run for office, but they are realizing that they are dear friends. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think they've come back to the romantic relationship yet where we are, but it's brewing.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. That is, so there are things that I want to spoil for you. So
don't
worry
about it.
It's one of the things that, that happens is Leslie is sort of confronted with a moment where the sort of future of her campaign will depend very heavily on her support system rallying around her.
Okay.
And one of the things that you and I mentioned was that, like, you know, her family is not a very reliable support system. Mm-hmm. Her mom is present in the narrative, but her mom is kind of a tough character, not a super available emotionally kind of person.
And is her role the president of the Board of Education?
Yeah, she's
and she's kind of aloof.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yes.
Just tough, mm-hmm. tough. Not somebody that Leslie has a lot of comfort being vulnerable with. Leslie's father passed away when she was young. She doesn't have any siblings so far as we can tell. So really doesn't have any, like, you know, quote unquote blood family to speak of. And so in this moment when it's like, you know, if her campaign's going to continue, she needs the support of her family, and everybody rises to the occasion. And it is, to me, I've always been compelled by this idea of, like, the family that you choose.
Yeah.
So often I meet with folks who are in this sort of crisis point because they are so distressed by, a lot of times it's their relationship with their parents. Mm-hmm. They find that their parents are, they're not all that kind, or they have really poor boundaries, or unfairly favor another sibling, or, you know, another sibling's kids or something like that. And there's this imbalance that exists, and their allegiance to that part of the family really depends on, I don't want to say, like, outdated values, but values that have gone unquestioned for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and if Leslie was at a place where she said, like, you know, the only people that I can really ask this really, really big task of are our family, she would be really disappointed and out of luck, because the only family member that's available to her is not somebody that she feels safe going to. So instead, in this moment when she feels comfortable, really accepting the support of people who, like, freely give of themselves, you know, and it's family that she's chosen. And a lot of them are coworkers. Some of them are not coworkers, but, you know, just people that, you know, she's kind of come into contact with. And so I think there's a really compelling idea there. And I'm wondering if either in work that you've done or in your own life, there's been this dynamic of sometimes the family that you choose being more, you know, more dependable, more reliable, more important in the, you know, in the way that your life unfolds, sometimes in the family that you're born into.
Yeah, I that resonates with me as far as having siblings. I'm an only child, and so I've always longed to have that sibling relationship. And what I long for is that deep family connection that I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to leave you, right? Like, there's something about a sibling of like, we're in it for life together. Where, and so I've filled that, I think, with really dear friends. But there's always this feeling of we're not family. But what I've learned as I, and so there was always a fear of they might leave me and I don't have a sibling that will always be with me. And then as I got older, so that was more adolescent thinking. And then as I got older, I realized how many siblings hurt each other deeply. Mm-hmm. And those wounds are almost worse because they're family.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I realized, oh, okay, we are all sort of choosing our families, whether we have them or not, whether they're healthy or not. No matter your circumstance, you end up kind of choosing the family members you stay close to or the non-family members that feel that same depth of closeness. So, yeah, I think this idea of choosing our family is really important. And I think that's part of the mentoring relationship I see with Leslie is it's like she finally has that parent figure that she was longing for.
Right.
And so she did choose and she kind of designed it, you know, by maybe not intentionally, but by forming a relationship with somebody where she could be cared for, that she reparented herself in that way. And we all have the opportunity to do that. But yeah, the concept of what is family, is that blood relatives or is that people you cherish and love? That word I think could use some for each of us is defined differently, but I do find that sometimes the people that we choose to do life with us really are truly family.
They're
in it with us no matter what.
One of the things I think I find compelling about Leslie's ability to foster those relationships is that, you know, there are a lot of ideological differences. Ron ideologically, politically is the polar opposite of Leslie, you know, staunch libertarian, small government. Like his whole role is to try to like, you know, bleed the belly of the, you know, kill the beast from within kind of thing. Even though he works in government, you know, Tom is completely image and money obsessed and, you know, just things that Leslie doesn't care for. But I think she sees past those ideological differences into the humanity of people and recognize that like these people would do anything for her. And what's interesting is I feel like when we look at our family relationships, it's those ideological differences that sometimes make those relationships so hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were mentioning this idea of blood. I don't know if I shared this on the podcast before, but the expression blood is thicker than water that I talk about, the full expression.
I don't think we've talked about that.
So the expression that you hear is blood is thicker than water, which is meant to say like, you know, these family bonds are the ones that really matter. The full quote actually means the opposite, which is the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb.
Wow.
So the covenant relationships that you form are far more impactful because of your choosing them than just the chance that you wind up in any particular family system.
That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, say the whole thing again.
The blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb.
Wow. Yeah. So making the covenant with somebody is more important than the biological.
Right, right. Awesome. And again, that is it. There are a lot of cultural contexts in which that notion isn't honored. It's you know, family over everything, you know.
Right.
There are people get tattoos, FOE, family over everything. But what I think is interesting is your definition of family, I think, can shape a lot of that. You know, and there are people who, to me, one of the more compelling people in my life, and every time I think of this person, I think of like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. So my sister had my niece Abby when she was 19, I think. And Abby's father was not super involved in Abby's life. But my sister had a long-term relationship with somebody who ended up, we're going to call him Manuel.
Mm-hmm.
That's not his name. And so during Abby's early life, Manuel was an important part of you know, Abby's, you know, growing up. And then, but my sister and Manuel were never married. They, you know, they ended up splitting up maybe when Abby was around 7, 8, nine, something like that. And Abby's 18 now. She's going off to college. And to this day, Manuel sees Abby every other weekend, is a regular part of her life, doesn't have any biological, legal obligation to this young woman, but chose her, but chose to, maintain that relationship and be important, even though that, I mean, and you, there's, you know, for every story like that, there's a million stories where something like that doesn't happen. But every time I think about Manuel, I'm thinking like, man, like there are not very many Manuels out there. And what can I do to be more like Manuel, to say to somebody like, hey, I choose you. And I'm going to lean into that, even though, you know, I don't have a quote unquote obligation to do so. And so that to me is, that's really the power of that. And I think that we, if our listeners hear anything from this, it's just like, take a moment to sort of reconceptualize your family, non-family relationships, and come to a place of recognition to say, like, just because you were born into a family, quote unquote, doesn't mean that as like an adult, you have to have a certain kind of relationship with people in your family. And just because people were not born into your family doesn't mean that you can't have meaningful, intentional, covenantal, even relationships with those folks.
Yeah, I love that. And to think about being the Manuel for, you know, for other people, like who am I a mentor for, and who am I investing in and giving my time to? I think that, you know, I've been trying to be more intentional just in the last couple of weeks of checking on my friends, because I was getting really involved with clients because, you know, we're all struggling through pandemic. And so my schedule really filled up. And I noticed my friends were feeling left out of my life. And one of them brought it to my attention, which was beautiful and brave. And I'm so glad she did. And I thought, oh, gosh, yeah, you're my people. And I'm forgetting to care for you, you know, and this is, and so I have realized, we've got to take care of those we choose as family too, and give them our time and our guidance, and not get so self-absorbed in our own lives that we forget that I am family to these people. And and that, you know, because I do go to the who's right in front of me at the moment is who I'm caring for. And when you think more largely of what is, how do I define family? And I do want to do life with these people the rest of my life. And so I need to be caring for them and making sure I'm letting them care for me. So I love, I love that example of how do we invest in somebody and truly care for them and want the, he truly wants the best for Abby and wants her to thrive, and he's investing in her, which is awesome.
As you were talking about, like, you know, the, it's easy to kind of focus on our immediate spaces. I was doing an interview with somebody this week, and the, we were talking about this idea of like which relationships are doing the best right now in the context of pandemic, and which ones are struggling. And we were sort of imagining, like, you know, if you put yourself at the center of a piece of paper and then draw a circle, and that's your, like, a household, those are the people you see every day. And then you draw another circle, and those are the people you maybe you interact with every week. And then you draw another circle, and that's maybe, you know, extended family, friends, etc. Like, we draw those circles intuitively based on you know, you kind of look at it as like, you know, your immediate family, then like family and friends, like, and family feels like it comes before friends. But I think part of what you and I are describing is what if you organized that circle differently? And instead of saying like, well, I've got to take care of my immediate family, and then I've got to make sure that my folks are doing okay. And then I've got, you know, and then if I can get to it, if I end up having enough time, maybe I can reach out to, you know, these other folks. And instead say, you know, who are the people that are most life-giving to me, and who am I most life-giving to?
That's right.
And say that, you know, and, you know, maybe in the conventional drawing, that person's, you know, five circles out, but you could decide like, hey, this person really, really, really matters in terms of like me being the person that I want to be, and having that dynamic with, and right now I'm in the midst of doing that with, a a close friend, a guy who's been my best friend since high school. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of this pandemic, it's just, it's been harder and harder for us to connect with each other. But we've just kind of said, you know what, we're going to do better. We're going to get together more often and, have a beer on the back mm-hmm. deck kind of thing. Even if some of the traditional venues that we were able to connect with aren't available to us. I want to encourage listeners that you have the freedom to decide which of those relationships matter and can lean into them, even if they might seem unconventional to whatever, standard wisdom you might be applying.
I love that redesigning that diagram and the life-giving word is really a good one to kind of filter mm-hmm. through the people in your life. Do they give you life and do you give them life? And when you were saying that, I was reminded of my daughter's preschool teacher said one day on the playground, Lauren was saying somebody stole the ball or was being mean or whatever. And the preschool teacher said, go to the people that make you feel good. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is the best life wisdom.
Yeah. Right?
Go to the people that make you feel good. Yeah. And not in a selfish way, but then you're your best self, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're good to them.
Right.
And so that has become, another way to kind of define who family is. Is it forcing ourselves to be with those that are biologically related to us but cause deep pain? That's not healing for either one of you. But finding people who make you feel good and you make them feel good, that could be family.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, it feels like we should end there just because that is go to the people that make you feel good, mm-hmm. regardless of what your last name is, regardless mm-hmm. of whatever mm-hmm. broader cultural obligation that you have. You can only be your best self around people who will let you be your best self.
Yeah.
And hopefully those are family. Mm-hmm. There are some, I mentioned, the clients who are stuck in mm-hmm. these really difficult family relationships. Like sometimes you can draw boundaries and enforce boundaries and change the dynamic of a relationship in a way that makes it healthy mm-hmm. and makes it life-giving. And sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can do everything in your power to draw those boundaries and that person will still treat you in a way that makes it hard for you to be your best self. Mm-hmm. And so I think ultimately where people end up is they have to say, is the value that informs the preservation of this relationship, is that going to take precedence over my own happiness, over my own ability to live freely? And it's not, my role as a therapist or anybody's role to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. But it is an important question to consider that those are the stakes. Sometimes it is the difference between I can stay in a relationship and be miserable, or I can say this relationship needs to take a back seat and then be the person that I want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, yeah. There wasn't a ton of Parks and Rec was our jumping off point, and maybe we'll revisit Parks and Rec once you get into some of the later seasons.
Okay.
Cause I think that there is a point that you will reach in season 7, that becomes a sort of defining moment in Leslie and Ron's relationship.
Okay.
That I would love to process
good.
when you get
cool.
there. So we'll do like a redux episode once we get to that point. But do you have anything else for...
What I love about our podcast, and I hope our listeners like this too, is we start somewhere and end up somewhere
yeah.
else. And I love that though, because it's both, and it's unscripted, and it's really us both thinking about things out loud. And
right.
and this is what we're all longing for, I think, is human conversation and deep mm-hmm. thinking and processing together. And this is how we grow.
Yeah, absolutely. So we highly recommend Parks and Rec.
Yes.
A diverse cast of characters, a very inclusive atmosphere, something that I think is really life-giving to a lot of folks. It's a balm in the context
laughter
of the pandemic, so.
Is certainly
yeah, yeah.
good medicine right
absolutely.
Now, and it does makes us laugh out loud.
Yeah, it does that. So it was good to be with you all today.
Yes.
I'm James Cochran. You can find out about my practice at talkingwithjames.com.
And I'm Ginger Rothis, and you can find me at compassionfix.com.
We'll be back next Friday with whatever we decide to talk about next Thursday, I imagine.
That's right.
So until then.
Be well.